This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on August 17th, 2017. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Oh, we'll call to order the open session of the Federal Election Commission on August 17th, 2017. And the first matter, first of all, Madam Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any late submitted documents?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Commission add to the agenda consideration of AO 2017-08 Point Bridge Capital LLC, and that the Commission determine pursuant to 11 CFR 2.7D that business so requires and no earlier public announcement was possible. I further move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the Commission may consider the following documents: agenda document number 17-35A, draft A, and 17-35B, draft B, of advisory opinion 2017-6, Stein and Gottlieb, and agenda document number 1736A, draft A, of advisory opinion 2017-8, Point Bridge Capital LLC.
Thank you very much. And for the record, let the record show that Commissioner Ellen Weintraub is with us by telephone. Is that correct, Commissioner?
That is correct.
Okay. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
None. The motion passes 5-0. Thank you. Okay. The Audit Division recommendation memorandum on the Illinois Republican Party.
Good morning, Commissioners. Before you is the Audit Division recommendation memorandum on the Illinois Republican Party. The memorandum contains six findings. In its response to the draft final audit report, the committee requested an audit hearing. The request was granted and the hearing was held on June 22, 2017. We're happy to answer any questions on these matters.
Thank you. Any questions? Commissioner Goodman.
Yes. I recall from the hearing and from rereading this proposed audit finding, specifically I'm focused on finding number four. Explain to me the inference that we've drawn from invoices from Revolvis Consulting in San Diego, California, to state party. Why are we? Can you just summarize for me why it is we are looking at what it is on these invoices that makes us conclude that there was an in-kind contribution to the party?
Okay.
In other words, summarize for me.
Yes.
I have an invoice in front of me, and I kind of want to understand this in context.
We have 14 invoices that break out to candidate Joe Plummer and Joe Walsh.
To Plummer and?
Joe Walsh. They are coded JW and JP. The invoices have on them the name of the mailer, the code on it, as example JP01, it says likely plumber, includes printing and design. The quantity is $44,405. The actual amount for that cost of the mailer itself for the 44,000 pieces is $7,988.65.
Okay.
Below that is an amount postage, $7,709, paid directly to the mail house.
Mm-hmm.
And then it shows the total below that of $15,697. The only amounts we can trace to the Illinois Republican federal accounts, and we've been looking at the state accounts, are the amounts that say amount. The actual amounts that say paid directly to the mailhouse never go through the Illinois Republican Party's bank.
Who's the mailhouse?
This will be Revolvis.
Are you sure?
Revolvis.
Revolvis
Is the billing company who, I don't know who actually the final say is, but Revolvis is the consulting company who ran these, yes.
Revolvis Consulting printed for example, there, I see Revolvis Consulting, an invoice, is billing for printing and design of a mail piece.
Yes.
Okay. So Revolvis is the designer and the printer.
To the best of my knowledge, okay. Yes.
So who's the mail house? Revolvis?
I don't know who. It could be them, but it's never been, there's documentation has never been provided to say it was otherwise.
Okay. Revolvis Consulting is located at 7185 Navajo Road, Suite P.
That's what's represented on the invoices.
Okay. Did you see in your audit of this committee other payments to a company called Envision for postage?
I believe Envision does appear, yes.
At 7185 Navajo Road, Suite P?
I couldn't tell you if that's it.
That's what's on the reports, isn't it?
I don't know if that's the exact address.
Okay. You might want to take a look at that, because I looked last night, and I find about $40,000+ in postage payments to a company called Envision at 7185 Navajo Road by the Illinois Republican Party.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I also see that this, the invoice you just cited to us, says bill to Plumber for Congress.
Yes.
Okay. So, and yet I have another one from Navajo, bill to the Illinois Republican Party.
Yes.
Okay. So, who paid this invoice? Plumber or the Illinois Republican
Party? Illinois Republican Party paid the $79.88.
Okay. But this was billed to Plumber, so apparently Plumber had some contractual relationship with Revolvis and or Envision as well?
I don't know that. We've seen this before in the Tennessee Dems, where the ultimate pay, well, the name of the committee appears on invoices if they were doing business prior with them.
So I see payments of $28,758.77 on October 31, 2012, from the Illinois Republican Party to Envision, located on Navajo Roads in San Diego, California, for postage. I see on October 26, 2012, a payment by the Illinois Republican Party to Envision on Navajo Road in San Diego for $12,598.69. And I see payments by the Illinois Republican Party to Envision at, on Navajo Road in San Diego of $1,960.72 on November 5 for postage. So I'm accounting for $44,000 in postage payments right on the face of the Illinois Republican Party's, I mean, this was right in our database on our website. And it's for postage at the same location. And yet the findings suggest that we find an in-kind contribution to the party for $72,000 for postage apparently paid. And I'm not thinking that we would, the mail house pay, that was for postage, so I'm seeing postage payments by the party to a separate mail house, which might be, which appears to be perhaps Envision?
It could be.
Could be. Okay. I guess there's ambiguity. I mean, the record gives us some ambiguity. And I can't tell, I can't make heads or tails of whether or not candidates or the NRCC or someone else may have paid the balance of $72,000, but I've seen one of these as an invoice to Plumber, so apparently Plumber was somewhat responsible for postage of $7,709 in postage paid directly to a mail house. And my point in raising this is just that I take an audit finding as an affirmative finding based on the evidence that there is a violation. I mean, that's there's no greater investigation than an audit. You know, you go in, you get all their materials, and the most clarity I get is an ambiguous entry on some invoices that there was a direct payment to a mail house for some postage, not necessarily Revolvis. And I'm finding a postage house called Envision at the same address, and I'm finding about $43,000 or $44,000 in payments for postage by the Illinois Party to Envision at the same address for postage. And yet I'm being asked, or what's being recommended is an affirmative finding, a definitive finding, that there was $72,000 in in-kind contributions of postage given to the Illinois Republican Party. Now, we had our hearing. We asked questions about this, and counsel, they were trying to recreate this 5 years hence as well. We're coming up on the five-year anniversary of these expenditures. And I'm uncomfortable saying that I have the clarity to make that type of finding. So on that one, but I'm, Mr. Chairman, I believe Marty wants to make
I just wanted to make a point that, you know, you mentioned ambiguity, and we provided this information to the committee at several, you know, junctures of the audit process. And as you pointed out, they tried to recreate it, but they weren't able to, you know, document who paid for this postage as well. And so that's kind of why where we were with this was somebody had to pay this postage, but we could not document who did pay it, and that's why we ended up with this finding as an in-kind. You know, we're not even sure, you know, who the in-kind might be from. That's why we're throwing it out here as a finding.
But I can explain to my satisfaction $43,000 worth of postage paid by the Illinois Republican Party for postage to the same address, but a different entity operating under the same roof, called Envision.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very possible that that's correct, but we had no documentation to verify that.
Either way,
that's my point. And yet what's being recommended to me is to make a definitive finding against the party, because we shifted the burden to the party to prove they didn't receive an in-kind, not because we affirmatively have established it based on our audit. And I don't feel comfortable shifting that burden, especially given that the recommendation is for $72,000, when I can explain $43,000 of it from the FEC's own reports that are on our computer. I see the postage payments of $43,000 delineated for postage to Envision at 7185 Navajo Road, Suite P, San Diego, California. And so maybe there's still a gap that's unexplained of $30,000 to me, but I'm uncomfortable deciding this ambiguity against the party, shifting the burden to them to explain it. It could be that some of the candidates paid some of the postage. It could be the National Republic, but nobody knows, and we haven't definitively established it. I understand what our audit division did. They found evidence of some value in postage, but it's unexplained. And there, I don't feel comfortable making an affirmative finding of this commission that there is necessarily an in-kind contribution. It could have been offsets. When you deal over a long period of time with one mail company, you make payments quite often, and then you make adjustments to the mailings that go out, and then the mail house sometimes credits you. And so there can be internal offsets. I mean, there are many other explanations for how to cover the $30,000, not $72,000 in my mind, but the $30,000 gap I see in these notations about direct postage being paid directly to a mail house. So I wanted to give my explanation for why I don't feel comfortable approving finding number 4 in the audit report. As for finding number 2, Mr. Chairman, this came up in the hearing. This committee has photos of several volunteer mail programs, projects. They have some sign-in sheets, but overall, I am prepared to credit 2 affidavits signed under penalty of perjury to this commission by a person who participated in those volunteer mailings and by the person who coordinated the volunteer mail program for the party. Because not only are they under oath, but the text of the affidavits is broad and declarative. One of them, the gentleman who ran the program, represents that he ran all of the mail programs. That was the only kind of mail that the party engaged in this election cycle. All of it was volunteer, and he has enough evidence of enough of the evening mail programs and says all of them followed that general pattern. So for that reason, I can't support recommendation number two. And I'm prepared to accept the other recommendations and support those.
Any further comment?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner Weintraub.
Recognizing that it probably wouldn't get four votes, I'm prepared to make a different motion. We've been over all these issues before at the hearing and previously, and I don't feel the need to go back through them again, but I am prepared to move approval of the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum in the Illinois Republican Party, A13-09.
Let me go on that motion for a minute. I've thought about this voluntary exemption issue long and hard for a long time, and I don't think it needs to be as amorphous as people make it out to be. But in this particular case, and given, and I have to look at the time involved when we're looking at 2012. I'm not too sure what you can do after that amount of time to buttress some of this. So I'm not going to find a violation on the volunteer exemption issue. There's, you know, pretty well-drafted affidavits, uncontroverted photographs were taken. I don't know much how much more could be done to tip us in the direction other than there was a bona fide effort to comply, it appears to me. And they may not have done it in the nth degree that we would like to have it, but it seems to me at some point we can't just ignore the affidavits, the sign-in sheets, and the photographs and that kind of thing. So I, under the circumstances, especially with the passage of time, I'm not going to hold up this and call it a violation. Commissioner Goodman.
Mr. Chairman, I was... we have a motion pending, then. Do you want to call that vote on this? That's for the whole report, and then we can take individual?
Yeah, we can do it that way.
Okay.
So all in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails. Commissioner Weintraub in favor. I opposed it. The vice chair opposed it. Commissioner Goodman and Commissioner Peterson.
Mr. Chairman.
Let's go kind of seriatim here.
Yeah, why don't we go seriatim, and that way everyone can toggle on and off each individual. Okay. Finding that they're convinced by. Mr. Chairman, in the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Illinois Republican Party, IRP A13-09. I move approval of recommended finding number one.
Now, let me, I'm looking at the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum, finding one misstatement of financial activity. I just want to make sure we...
This is misstatement of financial activity.
Mr. Chairman, am I still on the phone?
Yes, you are, actually.
Okay. It went silent for me for a while. I wasn't sure whether anything was happening.
We're just going to get our act together here.
Okay.
You've been there. I know you've been there before.
Yeah, sorry. It's hard to do this without the visual.
Just give us about 1 minute.
Do you want to go through seriatim? And I'll hold four in abeyance for the moment?
Sure.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Strike my previous iteration. So in the audit division recommendation memorandum of the Illinois Republican Party, A13-09 and the accompanying draft final audit report, I move approval of finding 1, finding 3, finding 5, and finding 6.
Anything further? Any comment, Commissioner Weintraub?
No, I'll go with that.
Okay. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? None. Motion passes entirely 5-0. Now, respect to finding.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we can use. What if we simply do not move 2 and 5? I mean, 2 and 4. I mean, do we need a, do we need, since they're recommended and before the body, do we need to have votes in response to those two recommendations? Is my motion that we move?
Mr. Calvert is advising me under Directive 70, it would be more helpful if the commission were to actually make the individual motions on the two findings that are still outstanding in some way.
The first motion we considered them and declined. Let me phrase them in a different way then, Mr. Chairman.
Real quick for the record, I show that we acted on 1, 3, 5, and 6. What remains is 2 and 4.
Yes, sir.
So we want to move separately.
And those were effectively rejected in the first motion, weren't they?
Do you want me to move 2 and 4 separately? I could do that.
Actually, I was going to make a differently worded motion with regard to those two, to reject those two. But I just didn't know if it was necessary.
I'm still thinking about 4, by the way.
I think that there's a sufficient difference in the motions, particularly considering that the outcome on the findings may differ.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, in regard to the current matter, the draft final audit report of the Illinois Republican Party and the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum, I move that we reject finding number 2 and find that the party provided sufficient evidence to establish the volunteer mail requirement.
Okay. So like I mentioned earlier, under the circumstances, I'll support that, especially due to the passage of time and the difficulty in trying to go further in connection with finding greater involvement. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Okay. The motion passes 4-1. Commissioner Weintraub voted against. I voted in favor. The Vice Chair, Commissioner Goodman, and Commissioner Peterson voted in favor.
And then, Mr. Chairman, in the same audit, I move that the Commission reject finding number 4 for lack of sufficient evidence to support the finding.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Sure.
With respect to the $30,000, assuming that money did get paid, except for the $30,000, what is the vagueness there? As I read it, the full amount was not credited. The full amount was counted because there was non-recognition of the document that Commissioner Goodman found, and assuming that constitutes a document that deserves consideration for the calculation, there would be only $30,000 left.
If you're accepting that, yes. I don't know what other things, if Envision is behind other mailings, or there's, I believe, 5 or 6 other vendors that did mailing. So I couldn't say and line those up. They could be, since the lack of documentation, they could be doing things for another vendor, which we never got support for. So that would really be hard to say that.
Well, I'll go ahead and reject the recommendation as well.
Okay. Call the vote, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay. The motion passes. Commissioner Weintraub voted against. I voted in favor. The Vice Chair voted in favor. And Commissioners Peterson and Goodman voted in favor. Okay. Anything further?
It's mixed as this one. But she has it all over and then.
Advisor opinion 2017-06. Counsel? You have so many comments to make?
Thank you, Chairman Walther. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 1735A and 1735B are alternative draft responses to an advisory opinion request submitted by Eli Stein and Jeremy Gottlieb. The requesters ask a number of questions about their proposed mobile app that would allow users to round up spare change from their debit or credit card transactions and contribute those amounts to candidates for federal office. Both drafts conclude that the proposed app is permissible and complies with applicable provisions of the Act and Commission regulations. We did not receive any comments on the request, and we received one comment on both drafts A and B. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have counsel for the requester available?
Yes, we do. I apologize.
I'd like to ask counsel.
Ms. Jonathan Burkon is there present.
Hello, Mr. Burkon.
Hello, Commissioner.
Would you care to comment on the comment that we received recently?
Yeah, absolutely. So we received the comment this morning, and I think a couple of points in response to it. Obviously, the commenter is, I think, without rival in his knowledge of the precedents of this commission and the regulations of this commission. And I think it's therefore notable that in his comment there is no legal citation. There's no authority that's been marshaled to support his position.
Excuse me, Mr. Burkham, but I thought his comment was that you don't have authority.
And respectfully, Commissioner, I have to disagree with that. I think we did include authority for our position on page 6 of our request. We make claim, and just to back up for a second, I think what Mr. Noti is raising is the question of whether a business that provides services is required to allow access to the platform, essentially, or to feature on the platform candidates that it determines based on commercially reasonable criteria, or whether it basically has to allow all candidates or feature all candidates in that platform. I think actually the commission has been quite clear on this point throughout the years. On page 6 of our request, we say that as the commission has previously concluded, there is nothing in the Act requiring a business entity to target its business toward clients or individuals that represent all parties or ideologies. That was in 1994. In the response in both drafts A and B, I think the drafts do a very good job of addressing this point. They've cited the CTIA wireless opinion, where they cite the fact that it's fine if due to commercial considerations to accept proposals from some political committees and not others. The 2012-26 Cooper for Congress, citing that no contribution in the committee where its participation was subject to objective and commercially reasonable criteria. And then advisory opinion 2006-34, which describes requesters' proposed use of common commercial principles to determine partner entities' commercial viability. So I think on the law, actually, the commission has been reasonably clear on this point throughout the years. I think another point is that it may be that the commenter, it seems like the commenter is essentially disagreeing with a factual representation we're making as opposed to a legal conclusion. I mean, we are representing in this request that commercially reasonable criteria will be used to determine which candidates are featured on the platform. If we don't comply with that, then we don't have the protection of the opinion. And the opinion that the commission issues is only as broad as the request that has been presented, and we have been clear that commercially reasonable criteria will be used to provide that. And I think the last point is that the commission has also been fairly clear over the years that the relevant criteria here is whether the services are being provided to the candidate committees or whether the services are being provided to the donors. And here, I think the commission has correctly found that the services are being provided to the donors. And in fact, there is a significant distinction between this request and a previous one on which the commission split, in that we are taking the extra step to say that candidates, there is no mechanism, there is no way for candidates to apply to be part of this platform, that those decisions are going to be made by the company based on commercially reasonable criteria.
Other questions? But, go ahead.
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Of course. Yeah, you're coming through clear.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize to the requester. I'm I don't have my normal papers in front of me. I was unable to bring the usual big fat notebook that I use with me. So bear with me. But the request, hang on. I'm trying to pull up the request on my electronically. The criteria for the candidates that you're going to be supporting, doesn't this hinge on there being Democrats in swing districts?
So as the request kind of made clear, based on the current political environment in which we live, the requesters have made a determination that basically doing a bipartisan platform is not commercially viable. As we said, if the political environment changes in subsequent years, that might be a different consideration. But right now, you kind of have to pick one side or the other in order to be able to effectively market it to the donors to which it would be marketed. So I think that's kind of point one on the partisan piece. On the second piece in terms of the swing districts, the goal of this is to make money. I mean, so the requester here wants to earn money, and they will earn the most money if they do the best job of identifying those candidates that generate the most interest. And I think it's their view that in the current environment there is some interest among Democratic-leaning donors to focus on seats that can take back the House of Representatives. It very well may be that there are particular candidates that objectively don't have as good a chance to win but prove to be popular with donors, those candidates would be featured. Like, the goal here is, in fact, to earn money and do well. So I think the objection, it seems, from the Campaign Legal Center is that there is potentially overlap between the effect of the commercially reasonable criteria and the fact that that might end up going to particular candidates. But in fact, what is driving the decision, as the request makes clear, are the criteria with the goal of actually doing well with this product.
Well, couldn't there be more than one motivation? I mean, it kind of sounds like the goals are to make money while flipping the house.
No, I think, first of all, there are a lot of vendors in the political space, and whether a vendor gets in the political space solely to make money or because, like, they have some other interests, ultimately the commission has been clear that vendors, if they charge a commercially reasonable rate for their services, are not making contributions to candidates. Perkins Coie does not represent Republican candidates. There are plenty of
Republicans. I recall that.
I knew you would. There are plenty of Republican vendors who don't represent Democratic candidates. Now, ultimately, they are driven by business interests. They charge a fee that earns them a profit, and that is ultimately the test.
I recall that, too.
Ultimately, that is the test that the commission has used, because it's frankly the only objective test that can be used. And the fact of the personal political affiliations of the businesses, or the effect that a effective service can provide in helping to flip elections, does not ultimately change the fact that as long as a business goes in, charges a commercially reasonable fee, and uses commercially reasonable criteria to make its decisions, I'm not aware of any situation where the commission has ever said that somehow is not in compliance with the Act. And in fact, you know, as both draft A and B cite and in our draft cite, there's plenty of examples in which the commission has been explicit that limiting the potential universe of consumers to a particular political party is in fact entirely permissible, and that there's no problem with that at all. So again, I do think that if Mr. Noti had some commission precedent in support of his position, he would have included it here, and the fact that there is none, I think, is indicative that the commission has just never taken this position before.
Well, as I read his comment, I think his point was that we would be extending previous guidance to a place where we haven't gone before.
Could you repeat that, Commissioner?
I read Mr. Noti's comment as not so much as saying that he had some particular precedent in mind that he thought this AO would be contrary to, but rather that were we to say yes, either via draft A or draft B, we would be extending our previous reasoning to a place where the commission has not gone before. This would be a new extension. And, you know, presumably that's why you asked, because you didn't think it was 100% clear from previous precedent.
Yeah, this was actually, I mean, look, when you bring a request to the commission, you kind of ask all the questions. What was actually motivating this was not the question of whether you could target your product to particular donors of a political persuasion. What was really motivating this was the deadlock that had happened in 2015 with the prior opinion, and trying to get clarity on what it means to be providing services either to a committee or to the donors. That is actually what motivated it. If the commission, I think, had come out entirely one way in 2015 or another, we probably just wouldn't have brought it. Because on the question of the ability to target to particular political audiences, the commission has been really quite clear. Again, I'll read back. There is nothing, this is from 1994, there is nothing in the Act requiring a business entity to target its business towards clients or individuals that represent all parties or ideologies. And, you know, respectfully, Mr. Noti does not cite any of these precedents. He doesn't say that drafts A or B go beyond these precedents. He just simply ignores them and says that any commercially reasonable criteria that possibly have some potential overlap with a political effect are inherently suspect. And that's just not a position the commission has ever taken. And frankly, it can't, because it would call into question vendor relationships with campaigns and PACs across the board. I mean, we'd haul in Perkins Coie, we'd haul in Jones Day, we'd haul in big ad firms on both sides and say, well, you know, why did you work with this candidate instead of that candidate? Is it because you wanted them to win more? Do you want them down to win more? I mean, there's no end to this principle. So I think it is I think the commission has been wise in the past to stay away from it. And as long as there are commercially reasonable criteria used, then that is the basis on which the commission has allowed products like this in the past.
Commissioner Weintraub, do you want to continue for a while, or
No, I'm done for now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Commissioner Goodman.
As I understand the service to be offered, it's an effective contributing service. Mm-hmm. We will help you target your money if you want to change the House. Mm-hmm. We will help you identify those key races where your money can make a difference. And that's what makes the service valuable, it seems to me, to a donor. Mm-hmm. Now, it may have residual benefit to those candidates or campaigns who happen to be so identified, but that's more a function of having to be in a competitive district or a competitive race or with a weak incumbent. It's other factors that make your race critical to changing the House, for example. And so if I want to employ a consulting service that has done the research to identify swing districts that can be changed, that you know, rather than waste my money on going against a incumbent Republican or Democrat, yours happen to be servicing Democratic donors or who are so inclined, I should be able to purchase that service, regardless of the fact that the service you're offering inherently is to be effective in making change, political change.
And I believe that the individual donor, I think what distinguishes this, we shouldn't have to try to distinguish between the motives, the subjective motives of the criteria to make money versus change the house. The objective here is to change the house, and that is the service that I'm purchasing and what distinguishes this, I think, from other direction and control issues is the fact that I'm paying a commercial service, a fee, to do it. And I'm comfortable that average citizens should have available to them the same type of consulting and research services to make their contributing effective that large, wealthy, sophisticated donors hire every day. They hire political consultants and lobbyists to help them target their resources at places where it really matters. And so I intend to support, when a vote is called, I intend to support draft A here.
Let me ask a couple of questions. I haven't been, historically, as you probably know, the biggest fan of this process, so forgive me if I appear to be not totally sold here. But if I understand it, you're giving money, the person receives money, they round it up, they get a certain amount of money, and it goes into the, and I guess the so-called project could be anybody. It could be... there's no requirements. The project has no obligation to report any money, or to create, you know, or to under any constrictions in connection with what it does. I assume. And who would be the project here? I see it's two individuals.
Yeah. So the, I mean, so the individuals are planning to form an entity, and obviously they wanted to wait until we had clarity on this piece of it before that happens. So the project will be an entity, whether it's an LLC, which is, I think is the intent. So that's actually when we say the project, it is simply referring to the entity.
So you got a two people, the project formers, create an entity, and we don't know, you know, under what law it is, whether it's a corporation or it's an LLC. There seems to be no limit on the individuals who could comprise it. So money is sent on a roundup program to them based upon what's commercially and it's spent based upon the most commercially reasonable basis in which to make the money worthwhile, I suppose, if you want to call it that way.
Well, I mean, so basically it's like if you have the product the way as it will develop on your phone, you will... as an individual, I will sign up with the product. And what that ends up doing is that every time I go buy a cup of coffee, you know, take an Uber, do anything else, it will round up the amount. So if it's, you know, $2.82 for a coffee, then it rounds up 18 cents. And it will keep rounding up so that at a certain point I will hit, let's say, the threshold of $10. And when that happens, those $10 will be distributed to candidates that I have selected through the app. So, and that will, and then a fee which is commercially reasonable and provides a profit to the project will be deducted and provided to the products that I'm paying, properly paying for the services that the product is providing. And through that mechanism, I am then, my money goes to the candidates that I have selected.
Okay, so if the money, $10 goes to candidate A, and then that person is chosen at a particular time to be the most commercially reasonable person to receive the money.
So the
commercially reasonable is the phrase that you're using all the way through our conversation. Mm-hmm. I want to dwell on that a little bit.
Yeah, so commercially reasonable speaks to the question of who is featured on the application. So the determination of who to feature on the application is made via commercially reasonable criteria. So once someone is on the application, at that point then the individual donors can choose which candidates they are going to support. At that point then the project's discretion is done. Like, they are not making subsequent decisions about the commercial viability of that candidate. So if the candidate is on my application, that is because a decision has been made that that candidate should be featured. And once then I have selected that candidate, my money is going to that candidate. So it's full choice by the donor once that candidate is on the app.
Okay, so you have this app.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me because I'm not.
No, I know.
I've got some apps, but I haven't convert them to political use yet.
You know.
So you have this app, and does it have on it candidate A, B, C, and D?
Mm-hmm.
And so on Tuesday, you go buy some toothpaste at the Safeway, and that goes to A. And then without any knowledge, the next day you go and buy yourself a T-bone somewhere, and that's candidate B.
It works slightly differently. So when I sign up, when I make a decision to participate in this app and I give my credit card information and agree to round up, at that point I will make a selection of which candidates on the app I want my money going to. So let's say...
Permanently?
No, not permanently. You can always choose. You can always switch. But until you make a subsequent decision. So I sign up, I give my credit card information, I decide I want to support candidates A and C on the app.
And on your app, you see which one
exactly
it goes to you, and they...
Yeah, and they provide different... What they're trying to do is entice participation, so you can... I can pick and choose. I can pick all the candidates. I can also... They're going to do selected buckets of, like, candidates from the South or candidates from the Mountain West, and I can pick those as well. But once I make my selection, let's say I choose candidates A and C, then I buy my toothpaste, I buy my T-bone, I buy several other things. I'm up to $25. It's split evenly between candidates A and C. So they each get $12.50. And let's say, you know, the extra has gone away.
So how,
I then decide I don't like candidates A and C anymore, and I want the rest of my money for the rest of the month going to candidates B and D. I make that selection. So it's complete donor choice of candidates. It's just that the decision about which candidates to feature, that is what the project is making a determination of based
on commercial
liability.
It's arbitrary in the sense that if you have candidate A and B, on one day candidate A would get X amount, and on one day candidate B may get more just because you had a bigger purchase that day.
No, so let's say I pick candidates A and C, and I don't make any more changes to the app the rest of the cycle. With the easiest example, it's going to be split evenly the entire time.
But
so
in what period of time?
Until I decide to change it.
And you can drop one candidate or add a candidate.
You can, yeah. So I think for ease of explanation, so I have candidates A and C. I choose them. I'm buying my toothpaste, my T-bone, my Uber, my Starbucks. It's just split evenly. So if I go on a spending spree on Monday, that's split evenly. And then I decide I need to save some money, and I only buy a couple of things Tuesday and Wednesday. It's a smaller amount, but it still goes equally to them. So it's not affected based on a day, unless then I decide to make a change in terms of how the product is used.
So when, just to go a little further, so as this adds up, pretty soon you get up to real money, say $50. And at that point, you need to keep track of the names of the people. But then you get up to $200, or you don't know, but the person who's participating with the app may have made a separate contribution to A, but not to B, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that money, if it's split, puts them over the 200 mark.
Mm-hmm.
And so reporting has to occur.
Yeah, so we as...
How does the app deal with these transactions where you don't have control over what the person is maybe donating through other sources?
Yeah, so we fully, the app fully accounts for that in several ways. The first is that before I put in my credit card information and select candidates, I am given a full disclaimer explaining the rules of contributions, the contribution limits, prohibited sources, and amounts. And I am required to certify that I am a permissible donor, I'm a citizen, I'm not a corporation, and that I acknowledge this. So that's one. Two, all that information is collected. So once my money is actually processed, the app will send to the recipient committee, along with the money, a list of donors with name, address, occupation, employer. So the recipient committee gets that information just like they do on any credit card donation that comes in. They're tracking that information on their end.
Do they get that from day one?
Yes. Once the first contribution is processed, yeah.
Is there a time period? Is it every month?
The way they're planning to do it is actually because they don't want to kind of do it every day. Let's say $10 is the threshold that's selected. The money that I have, essentially, the roundups, once they hit $10, then the amount will be processed and within 10 days will be sent to the recipient committee. So it's not based on dates in the calendar, it's based on hitting like a $10 total threshold. And if I actually, and here further to your point about donor choice, if I'm only at like $9 and I decide, hey, I don't want to do this anymore, I want to withdraw from the system, I actually get my money back. So it's not even until I hit the $10 that the money gets transmitted. The other thing that we do, though, is the project is going to send a receipt not only to the recipient committee but to the donor. So the donor will get an email receipt at the email that she or he provided in the first place with, here is where your money went. So that if I gave $150 through the app, but I, you know, to candidate A, but I had gone to candidate A's fundraiser and written $2,700 or $2,500, I know I'm right at the cap of that limit. So we provide information to the donor so she or he can track their limits, and to the committee so they can track limits on their end.
So what happens, since there's no obligation to report above 200, below 200, some information, what happens to that information?
So the recipient committee will receive the information of anyone who gives.
I guess to be so pervasive with with the information that needs to be provided, if somebody never gives more than $10 on the list, there's your employer, your address, your all the information that goes with something that's a higher contribution, but that information is now out on a list which shows, which would in theory to the project, you would have that list as the people whose predilection was to vote for X or Y, or I mean it would be a list that could be very valuable.
Well, I mean that's kind of inherent.
Is there a guarantee that information would not be made known, or that you wouldn't be selling that list?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that frankly came up here because it's not really a provision of the Federal Election Campaign Act, but, you know, that's something I can go back to my clients and discuss. But, I mean, you know, that's a question that's governed by privacy policies and internet sales generally. So the issue you raise is a good one, but frankly, it's an issue that's already completely baked into the system. So if I go on to, Hillary Clinton's website when she's running for president, and I write a contribution for $5 with my credit card, like, they're still asking for my occupation employer because they need to in order, once I get over 200, to be able to report it. And so they now have my employer information, you know, the merchant account has my information. So that piece of the system in terms of privacy of people's information is, I think, a very, very important issue, and one that we deal with as lawyers to committees. But I actually don't think it's within the purview of this commission, only because it's just not a provision of the federal election.
Well, it concerns me that through this process, someone could use the process to really make the money out of the list. Where you have, normally you don't have an obligation to contribute anything until you get to $300. At $50, is, you know, there needs to be a record of who it is. But I guess if you've got all this information that's out there, it could be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who've only given a little bit amount and never made it to the $200 threshold. That information is now out there where they never would otherwise have to do it. And I recognize you can argue that that's not our bailiwick, but I did want to...
It's a very important issue. The way that is dealt with, and the only reason I say it's just not subject here is because it is governed by a whole other set of laws. I mean, if you go to a website of a campaign, they have very, very detailed privacy policies that specify exactly how your information can and will be used. It's a big part, again, of what I do is advising candidates on that privacy policy and the laws that govern it, and the same thing would be true here. So I think you can have confidence that there is a legal regime that governs it. I just don't think it is. The reason it hasn't come up in this request is just not this agency's purview. But it is something that I think all committees take very, very seriously, that the project would take very, very seriously, and that would be governed within the project's privacy policy.
Well, there seems to be no, I mean, I don't know how it would work once it gets out into the opening. They read this new advisory opinion, and all of a sudden there crops up a group of people who do this.
I think they already are. I mean, I think this is a variant on it.
I'm suggesting that there may be somebody other than your clients who would do it.
Oh, no, I just mean that this app obviously has certain things that distinguish it, but apps like this have been kind of brought before the commission before, and people give online through ActBlue and Democracy Engine and all sorts of other entities that are, you know, very, very closely related to this as well. So I think the issues you raise are vitally important in the field of online contributions, but it's, you know, that whether this project succeeds or not commercially, those issues are going to exist in the exact same way.
So I'm going to cut it short because people are probably getting pretty bored, but really quick, on the issue of the commercially reasonable,
mm-hmm.
what are you speaking with exactly? It's commercially reasonable. Are you picking the candidates who are most likely to get the contributions, and therefore they're on your list, and some candidate who's just plugging along and doesn't have much going for them yet doesn't get the benefit of the app because they're not on a list?
So, again, I think it's the service here is not being provided to candidates. The service is being provided to the donor community, which is important because the commission has historically distinguished between the two, between products where we are essentially going to campaigns and saying, hey, sign up with us. That's not what this is. This is targeting actually a donor universe and going to donors, through different means and saying, hey, this is a good way for you to participate in the political process. The commercial criteria, yes. I mean, I think as any entity that wishes to do well and wishes to make money on any contribution that is given, the project will make a fee, a commercially reasonable fee, which is what makes this whole project legally permissible. And the entity wants to maximize the fees that it earns. So it's going to determine, ultimately, it is what its goal is to use criteria that figure out who are the most likely candidates to generate fees for the company. Now, I'm sure there'll be some trial and error. It's not a science, so there'll be, you know, figuring out those pieces. But that's the goal. They want to make money.
Thanks. I apologize for taking so much time.
No, please. These are great questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Goodman.
Yeah, I just, perhaps at the expense of repeating myself, it strikes me that commercially reasonable here is defined by reference to what donors want, not necessarily going to campaigns or the Democratic National Committee and saying, what will be most useful for you for us to raise money for? It's what service do donors want to purchase? Am I right?
100%. And the two really do differ. I mean, I think as a recent example, obviously in the special election in Georgia, if our project was around then and they had set up there, they would have made a lot of money having people give to the Democratic candidate in Georgia. And then after the election, when he lost, there was a lot of kind of hubbub about, was this actually the best use of donors' money for the Democratic Party? And a lot of people didn't think it was. That's a question for debate. But ultimately, from the project standpoint, they're all in. This was a popular candidate with donors and kind of fit the overall brand. And they would have been all in with that candidate, even though ultimately, the party might have decided it's actually not the best race for all of our money to invest in.
But, Mr. Chairman, if a commercial vendor wants to offer a service to Democratic-leaning donors that says, give through us and we will help you identify those key House races that will help change the House. Right. We've done the research. That's part of our service to you. We've identified the top 20 swing districts where the Democratic challengers have the greatest chance. There could be a challenger service. There could be an incumbent service of incumbents in jeopardy. But it strikes me that as a donor, I might like to purchase that service from a vendor. And I assume that the vendor is going to be keeping tabs on donor interests like that. Many donors, especially at this level, we're talking about change here. We're talking about macking up your dollar, your 80 cents to a dollar. Many of those people may not be capable of identifying the 20 top most competitive districts that would help change the House. So I might want to purchase this service, and I take it that the service is going to tailor it's marketing, it's identification to that type of donor interest.
Yeah. I think you're 100% right, Commissioner Goodman. I mean, part of this is, you know, you have donors who are out there who want to achieve a goal, in this case, to elect more Democrats to the House and perhaps the Senate. But there's an information gap, which is what Commissioner Goodman is saying. Like, the wealthiest donors, they hire people, they know, you know, the polling data in each particular race and whether this mail piece can do this and that. Like, someone who's just, you know, out there who's a Democrat who wants to participate in the process, they don't have the time or the wherewithal to figure out, you know, whether this race is more competitive than that race. So part of what this, the reason why this service costs money for the donor, the reason why there is a fee, is that they're going to be doing some work to kind of like lay all of that out there so that, that donors are educated about it and so that that information gap, you know, to some degree is filled. But obviously within the universe of people that the app identifies, the donor will have substantial choice within it to figure out what she or he wants to do.
Mr. Chairman, I have one other question. Yeah,
Commissioner Goodman, of course.
I think I understood your request to say, until I reach $10, you're not going to be banking the money. In other words,
Right.
You're not going to be holding the money like a bank.
Exactly.
Okay. You're going to be keeping track of
the
roundups.
Exactly.
Accounting for it and then charging my credit card or my debit card, whatever I set up with you. Then you're going to charge it as a separate transaction.
Exactly. So once you hit $10 in roundups, then it will actually charge and there will be a $10 fee, or if it goes over to $10.07 with that purchase, that's what the actual fee is going to be.
Understood. That's when it comes out of the account? How's that work anyway?
Yeah, so I mean, just like anything else on your credit card.
These little incremental bumps is about every month or something like that.
Well, it depends on how frequently you purchase stuff. So it's just like any other, you know, charge on your bill. So, you know, again, you have your toothpaste for $2.42 and your T-bone for $22 and the case may be. And then once it's rounding up those amounts, but once it goes over $10, that's the threshold, then there will be another charge for $10.09, right? That's just like another fee to the project. So it'll just be another charge on your card, and then when you pay your monthly bill, you'll pay your monthly bill, and that will be part of it.
Thanks. Apologize for so much time.
No, this is great.
Commissioner Weintraub?
Yep.
Okay. Any questions?
No hands.
Okay. Well,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner.
I actually have a question for Mr. Burkhan. So first of all, let me say that I think that your answers to my questions were very good.
Thank you.
And well done.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the thoughtfulness of your answers, particularly given that we all just saw that comment for the first time this morning. I would like a little bit more time to think about this, if your client would be willing to give us an extension. Because in addition to that issue, there's the other issue that the two drafts are not entirely on the same page on, which is your attempt to find a way to get four votes for an answer, unlike the 2015 requester that you were that you referred to and were cognizant of in drafting your request. So in any event, I think there would be a need to try and find a way to thread that needle between the two drafts. But as I said, I'd also like a little bit more time to think about your answers and the concerns that were raised by the CLC.
I would add to that, the one concern I have, and it's great that you're here because it's educational and everything, but I am concerned that the public hasn't had the amount of time they typically would have to give to comment. So I see Madhava, he got busy right away. But in the interest of that, I support that too. And I will tell you, I'm more on the fence than I thought I was going to be. So,
in a good direction or in a bad direction?
Well, actually,
for us?
Given my history, it's a good direction for
okay.
you.
Okay. I mean, so let me just address.
I'm not making any guarantees either.
Let me just address a couple of points. So the first, between draft A and draft B, I actually, like, to be clear, we are completely fine with either one. I actually don't think there's any substantive difference between the two drafts at all. Draft B simply kind of makes explicit or underscores the point which is implicit in Draft A, which is that there is a factual difference between this request and the 2015 request. So it just simply says that, acknowledging explicitly that there's a factual difference, and, you know, I think the purpose of that language in Draft B is to say there's nothing in this draft that kind of changes anything we decided in 2015-9. So if we can get four votes today for Draft B, we are 100% for that. The second point, obviously, look, like, we would, if we don't have four votes yet, we would, I have to ask my client, but presumably we would prefer to have some sort of extension rather than, you know, lose. But, you know, they want to get going. Like, the election's coming up. The Act requires the Commission to respond within 60 days. And, you know, we requested an almost at that 60-day mark now. And, you know, time is of the essence from a competitive standpoint. So I, you know, while I completely understand, obviously, their particular circumstances here, you know, we did follow the process, and we would like an answer, you know, as soon as we can. So I'm happy to ask for that if that's what's being requested, but I think we would ask in return that it be done expeditiously and we don't have to wait until the next meeting, for example.
Procedurally, I don't know if we can do that, because I think to collaborate, we need to do it in open public. I mean, I guess it's procedurally it might be possible, but I don't know you could guarantee that. Okay. How would that work? We would have to collaborate, and in some way we'd have to reconvene.
I was thinking more on the lines, sorry, before you enter, on the lines of between Draft B and Draft A. I know in the past there have been, for technical things like that, there, you know, the Commission has kind of done its tally votes in between hearings when there's been a full airing on the substance, and the distinctions are, you know, obviously there you need to have something that you're voting on, but really the two are, I think, substantively identical, even though they're slightly different language.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Weintraub.
I believe that we could, if four or more commissioners could come to an agreement on language, we could circulate, we could put a draft out, make it public, so that the requester and anybody else would have a chance to see it before we voted on it, you know, give it 24 or 48 hours and then vote on it by tally. I think we could. We tend to put these things over till the next meeting, but it is definitely possible for us to get it done on paper.
Well, the Commission wanted to guarantee that we'll do it that way. I mean, if that will work, then it will work.
Yeah, and look, I need to obviously go back to my client and get confirmation. When is the 60 days up? Is it a few days?
Monday.
Okay. So we can get you just via email, you know, today, just an answer to that. But that's, you know, obviously we do want to get going with this, you know, given that time is of the essence.
Any thoughts? Should we proceed on? Commissioner Peterson, you're...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would hope that we could resolve it before we have to come back to another meeting. Just for the record, I also support Draft Day. I think that any invitation to go beyond the evaluation of commercially reasonable criteria and to try to peek below the surface and try to ascertain motives and to question whether or not, well, are these the most commercially reasonable criteria, or wouldn't it even be more reasonable if you provided the service to this further universe of candidates or committees or so forth? I think we'd be going down a rabbit hole that would not be productive. And I think that we're on much firmer ground when we're looking at the more objective test of commercially reasonable activity, determining whether they're providing a service to contributors, as they are in this case, and looking to make a profit. I think this is from the draft is firmly grounded in Commission precedent, and I think it's that the precedent along that we followed in the past, I think, was wisely considered. I would be very reluctant to veer from that, because I think we'd be going down a very unproductive path. So I would hope we could find that common ground. I would note that it seems, as Mr. Burkon pointed out, the major point of departure, and it's not a, a very major part, is just, I think it's language, just regarding, let me see what, I believe it's just the language regarding the factual distinction.
Yeah.
To the extent that, that some want that in there and feel that that's important, we could even put something akin to that in a footnote to say that maybe some commissioners felt that it was important that there, that this distinction, this factual distinction between this and prior matters is you know, occurs in this instance. And maybe that would be an easy way that we could thread the needle, because other than that, there's really not a whole lot of substantive difference. And if that is the case, then I would hope that we could resolve this on tally before we have to come back to another meeting.
Further comment? Well, we'll leave it at that, I guess, and see what we can do along that line. I guess there's no way to guarantee how it's going to turn out, but you need to get back to us, I guess.
Yeah, I'll check with the client and get back to you guys this afternoon.
All right, thank you, Council.
Great, thank you.
We'll do, go to the doctor at 5:30. So maybe. We're going to take a break for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to continue until 1 o'clock, and then we'll go from there. And then I'll, then Commissioner Hunter will be running the show.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
When you say we're going to take a break and then continue, is the open meeting going to continue, or are we going into exec?
I think we probably need to finish the open session.
We only have one.
Just a second. Yeah. So what do you want to do?
It's, do it now. I don't intend to debate the next one. If you just want to move it to a vote, we can move right to a vote.
All right. Is there any debate to be had? Let's put it that way.
Excuse me. Yes. I'm prepared to support the draft on the other request.
Okay, I'm told the requester's counsel is on the phone. All right.
Mr. Lykin?
Pardon me?
Mr. Lykin, are you with us?
I am on the phone. Thank you.
He is with us, Mr.
Hello,
Chairman.
Mr. Lykin.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for joining us. I hope we didn't keep you on the phone or waiting too long. This took a little longer earlier than we anticipated. So I hope it didn't run up. Now we're going to draft advisory opinion 2017-08.
Thank you, Chairman Walther. Agenda document 1736A is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by Point Bridge Capital, LLC. The requester asks a number of questions about its proposal to establish an index of publicly traded securities based on support for a political party and its candidates, and to establish an exchange-traded fund based on that index. The draft concludes that the proposed index and ETF are permissible under the Act and Commission regulations, and that the requester would not be required to file any reports with the Commission. We did not receive any comments on the request or on the draft. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Goodman.
I just want to give Mr. Lykin an opportunity if he wanted to react to the draft that he sees.
But there is an old saying that when you've got things going for you in court, you don't have to.
Yes.
You don't start asking questions.
That's true. As a courtesy, he's on the phone.
Of course, I'm just making the comment that looks pretty good.
Yeah, that may be advice to you, Mr. Lykin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Goodman. It does not appear necessary that I address the substance of the request, but I would like to comment on the process. I cannot overstate how grateful I am that FEC staff, particularly Ms. Walt Strecker and Robert Knopp, and really everyone on the commission who has touched this AOR, took what was my problem and made it their priority. They went above and beyond the call, and I truly appreciate it. And I'm not sure if this is the right term to use, but I feel like I've received outstanding customer service from the commission. So, again, thank you to those two individuals and to the entire commission.
Thanks very much. That's very nice to hear. Kind words often, or not that often here. So, we'll take them as we can get them. And do I hear a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of agenda document number 17-34-A.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? None. The motion passes 5-0. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. for waiting for us, Mr. Lycan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So we'll pick up in about 10 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, if you're going to adjourn this meeting, did you want to raise the question about management and administrative matters?
I guess we're done with the meeting. Yes, we'll do that. Are there any management or administrative matters discussed?
Mr. Chairman, there are no such matters.
Okay, thanks. Meeting's adjourned.